Chapter 4. You'd be surprised what goes on around here. Lieutenant Harawa Takeda, 30-year-old flight officer on the cruiser Tone, was a disappointed, worried man as the Japanese striking force hurtled southward, now less than 250 miles from Oahu. He was disappointed because last-minute orders kept him from piloting the Tone's seaplane, which was to take off at 5:30 a.m., joining the Chikuma's plane on a final reconnaissance of the U.S. fleet. And he was worried because, as the man in charge of launching these planes, he feared that they would somehow collide while taking off. True, the two ships were some 8 miles apart, but it was still pitch black. Besides, when the stakes are so high, a man almost looks for things to worry about. Nothing went wrong. The planes shot safely from their catapults and winged off into the dark, two small harbingers of the great armada that would follow. Admiral Nagumo planned to hit Pearl Harbor with 353 planes in two mighty waves. The first was to go at 6 a.m., 40 torpedo planes, 51 dive bombers, 49 horizontal bombers, 43 fighters to provide cover. The second at 7:15 a.m., 80 dive bombers, 54 high-level bombers, 36 more fighters. This would still leave 39 planes to guard the task force in case the Americans struck back. By now, the men on the carriers were making their final preparations. The deck crews, up an hour before the pilots, checked the planes in their hangars, then brought them up to the flight decks. Motors sputtered and roared as the mechanics tuned up the engines. On the Hiryu, Commander Amagai carefully removed the pieces of paper he had slipped into each plane's wireless transmitter to keep it from being set off by accident. Down below, the pilots were pulling on their clean underwear and freshly pressed uniforms. Several wore the traditional hashimaki headbands. Little groups gathered around the portable Shinto shrines that were standard equipment on every Japanese warship. There they drank jiggers of sake and prayed for their success. Assembling for breakfast, they found a special treat. Instead of the usual salted pike mackerel and rice mixed with barley, today they ate sekihan. This Japanese dish of rice boiled with tiny red beans was reserved for only the most ceremonial occasions. Next, they picked up some simple rations for the trip, a sort of box lunch that included the usual rice balls and pickled plums, emergency rations of chocolate, hardtack, and special pills to keep them alert. Now to the flight operations rooms for final briefing. On the Akagi, Commander Mitsuo Fuchida, leader of the attacking planes, sought out Admiral Nagumo. "I am ready for the mission." "I have every confidence in you," the admiral answered, grasping Fuchida's hand. On every carrier, the scene was the same. The dimly lit briefing room, the pilots crowding in and spilling out into the corridor. The blackboard revised to show ship positions at Pearl Harbor as of 10:30 a.m. December 6th. Time for one last look at the enemy lineup, one last rundown on the charts and maps. Then the latest data on wind direction and velocity, some up-to-the-minute calculations on distance and flying time to Hawaii and back. Next, a stern edict. No one except Commander Fuchida was to touch his radio until the attack began. Finally, brief pep talks by the flight officers, the skippers, and on the Akagi by Admiral Nagumo himself. A bright dawn swept the sky as the men emerged, some wearing small briefing boards slung around their necks. One by one they climbed to the cockpits, waving goodbye. 27-year-old Ipei Goto of the Kaga in his brand-new ensign's uniform. Quiet Fusata Iida of the Soryu, who was so crazy about baseball. Artistic Mimori Suzuki of the Akagi, whose Caucasian looks invited rough teasing about his mixed blood. When it was Lieutenant Hayita Matsumura's turn, he suddenly whipped off the gauze mask which had marked him as such a hypochondriac. All along, he had been secretly growing a beautiful mustache. Commander Fuchida headed for the flight leader's plane, designated by a red and yellow stripe around the tail. As he swung aboard, the crew chief handed him a special hashimaki headband. "This is a present from the maintenance crews. May I ask you to take it along to Pearl Harbor?" In the Akagi's engine room, Commander Tanbo got permission and rushed topside for the great moment, the only time he left his post during the entire voyage. Along the flight decks, the men gathered, shouting good luck and waving goodbye. Lieutenant Ebina, the Shokaku's junior surgeon, trembled with excitement as he watched the motors race faster and the blue exhaust smoke pour out. All eyes turned to the Akagi, which would give the signal. She flew a set of flags at half-mast, which meant to get ready. When they were hoisted to the top and swiftly lowered, the planes would go. Slowly, the six carriers swung into the wind. It was from the east and perfect for takeoff. But the southern seas were running high, and the carriers dipped 15 degrees, sending high waves crashing against the bow. Too rough for really safe launching, Admiral Kusaka thought, but there was no other choice now. The Pearl Harbor Striking Force was poised 230 miles north and slightly east of Oahu. The time was 6 a.m. Up fluttered the signal flags, then down again. One by one, the fighters roared down the flight decks, drowning the cheers and yells that erupted everywhere. Commander Hoichiro Tsukamoto forgot his worries as navigation officer of the Shokaku, decided this was the greatest moment of his life. The ship's doctors, Captain Endo and Lieutenant Ibina, abandoned their professional dignity and wildly waved the flyers on. Engineer Tanbo shouted like a schoolboy, then rushed back to the Akagi's engine room to tell everybody else. Now the torpedo planes and dive bombers thundered off, while the fighters circled above, giving protection. Plane after plane rose, flashing in the early morning sun that peaked over the horizon. Soon all 183 were in the air, circling and wheeling into formation. Seaman Iki Kuramoto watched on the verge of tears. Quietly, he put his hands together and prayed. For Admiral Kusaka, it had been a terrible strain getting the planes off in these high seas. Now they were on their way, and the sudden relief was simply too much. He trembled like a leaf, just couldn't control himself. And he was embarrassed, too, because he prided himself on his grasp of Buddhism, Bushido, and Kendo, a form of Japanese fencing, all of which were meant to fortify a man against exactly this sort of thing. Finally, he sat on the deck, or he thinks possibly in a chair, and meditated Buddha fashion. Slowly, he pulled himself together again as the planes winged off to the south. At the main target of this onslaught, the only sign of life was a middle-aged housewife driving her husband to work. Mrs. William Blackmore headed through the main Pearl Harbor gate, past the Marine sentry who checked her windshield sticker, and headed down to the Harborcraft pier. Mr. Blackmore, 16 years in the Navy and presently chief engineer of the tug Kiyosakwa, was to get underway at 6 a.m. to meet the supply ship Antares and take over a steel barge she was towing up from Palmyra. As Mrs. Blackmore dropped her husband, the first gray light of morning gave the rows of silent warships an eerie, ghostly look. "This," she observed, "is the quietest place I've ever seen." "You'd be surprised what goes on around here," Blackmore replied cheerfully, and he jumped aboard the tug for another day's work. The Kiyosakwa moved down the harbor, through the long, narrow entrance channel, and past the open torpedo net, which was kept open still longer for whenever the tug should return. It was now 6:30 a.m., and the Antares was already in sight, towing the barge about 100 yards behind her. The Ward hovered about a mile away, and a Navy PBY circled above, apparently looking at something. Seaman H.E. Ranbig, the Ward's helmsman, was looking at something, too. As the Antares came up from the southwest and crossed the Ward's bow to port, he suddenly noticed a curious black object that seemed to be fastened to the tow line between the Antares and her barge. They were about a mile away, and so he asked Quartermaster H.F. Geerin to use his glasses for a closer look. Geerin immediately saw that the black object was not hanging on the hawser, but was merely in line with it. Actually, the object was in the water on the far side of the Antares. He showed it to Lieutenant Geppner, who said it looked like a buoy to him, but to keep an eye on it.